of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello and Happy New Year. This is Bahati Mutisia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Teen Magazine. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Teen Vogue and, just Teen Vogue today. Our first article from Teen Vogue is titled, The History of New Year's Resolutions. From the ancient Babylonians to today, see why we make New Year's resolutions. This article is by Kate Dwyer and was published December 31st, 2017. Get healthier, enjoy life to the fullest, spend less, travel more. These were some of Americans' most popular New Year's resolutions last year. Each January, about 40% of the country make New Year's resolutions, and setting a goal at the start of the year is as much a part of the festivities as watching the ball drop in Times Square. But when you think about it, New Year's resolutions don't make a lot of sense. You can decide to get healthy any time during the year, so why has January 1st become the de facto goal-setting holiday? Why not a birthday, the start of your new year, or the first week of a new school year? The tradition of making New Year's resolutions goes back over 4,000 years to the ancient Babylonian festival of Akitu. During this 12-day celebration, the Babylonians would celebrate the rebirth of the natural world. They would plant crops, crown a new king, or reaffirm the power of the reigning king, make promises to their gods, and pay back their debts. Here's where the New Year's resolutions come in. The Babylonians believed if they kept their promises to the gods, they would stay on the gods' good side, and if not, they would fall out of favor. In 153 BC, the Roman Senate declared that January 1st would signal the start of the new year, honoring the god Janus, according to the Washington Post. Because Janus was said to have two faces, he could look forwards and backwards at the same time, symbolizing the end of the previous year and the start of the new year ahead. However, it took over 100 years for this to take effect. Julius Caesar made it official around 46 BCE. Romans, similar to the Babylonians, would make promises to Janus about their behavior for the next year. During the Middle Ages, knights would renew their vows to chivalry by placing their hands on a live or roasted peacock, Slate reports. The peacock vow was the annual contract taken at the end of each year, aka a resolution to uphold the values of knighthood. Things have come a long way since then. Modern New Year's resolutions became a thing in the 19th century. The first recorded use of the phrase New Year resolution appeared in a Boston newspaper in 1813. Still, while over a third of the population make New Year's resolutions every year, only 8% follow through with them. The best way to make sure you achieve your resolution is to treat it like a regular goal. Make it specific and tangible so you can track your progress. While getting healthier seems great on paper, the only way to measure your success is by developing an action plan and following it. If you want to spend less and save more, think about skipping that trip to Starbucks. And our next article is titled, Martin Luther King Jr. Was More Radical Than We Remember. Let's do his memory justice. This article is by Jen M. Jackson. It was published May 31st, 2020, and this is a part of the OG History series for Teen Vogue, where we unearth history not told through a white, cis-hetero, patriarchal lens. In this installment, writer Jen M. Jackson explores the radical nature of Martin Luther King Jr., whose legacy, she says, was whitewashed over time. The earliest lesson I learned about Martin Luther King Jr. was that he had a dream. delivered in his most well-known speech at the 1963 March on Washington, as posed to me and as I understood clearly in my adolescent mind, that dream was a colorblind one. The manufactured perspective, often told to young children and supported by mainstream, predominantly white commentators, was focused on erasing the division, on erasing the divisions between black and white people, not necessarily by blaming white people for their participation in a system of anti-black racism, but by moving beyond racial differences altogether. But that was never actually King's dream. He was much more radical than that. In 1954, King was finishing a doctoral dissertation at Boston University. Soon, he was thrust into the political limelight early on in his career as a 25-year-old pastor of Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama. The political moment necessitated a radical approach to politics. He was pastoring as Brown v. Board of Education was decided, effectively ending legal segregation in the United States. This monumental civil rights win and the promise of freedom of public movement for black Americans signaled an era of struggle and triumph for King and those who believed in his nonviolent cause. On the heels of Brown, King was just 26 when he helped facilitate and led the Montgomery bus boycott, which started on December 5, 1955, and lasted over a year. It is estimated that the Montgomery bus lines lost 30,000 to 40,000 bus fares each day because of the boycott. For 381 days, boycotters walked or carpooled to and from their destinations. The boycott and a legal challenge forced the Montgomery City Lines bus company to desegregate their fleet by November of 1956, which sparked years of nonviolent organizing in the South. It was King's unconventional engagement tactics, organizing black communities through direct action on buses, at lunch counters, libraries, and many other public facilities that quickly elevated his name among national movement circles and mainstream media alike. But this effort didn't spring forth from nothing. Black women and girls, like 15-year-old Claudette Colvin and 42-year-old Rosa Parks, first refused to obey segregation laws on Montgomery buses that relegated black riders to the back rows and mandated they give up their seats to white riders, and had been gaining attention before its start. And the pressure cooker like conditions of many southern cities stoked the flames of a burgeoning civil rights movement galvanized by the gruesome kidnapping and murder of 14-year-old Chicago-born Emmett Till while visiting family in Money, Mississippi in August of 1955. Till's murder had a profound effect on King, as it represented the horrors of the anti-black racism he was bracing himself to stand against. By 1963, the year four little girls were killed in cold blood by KKK members, King had already made frequent trips to Alabama, even getting arrested during his nonviolent protest of racial segregation with the Southern Christian Leaders Conference, SCLC. The sanitized version of King's life and work, the colorblind I Have a Dream narrative, often fails to acknowledge how King's increasing profile as a radical, anti-racist organizer drew antagonism from the FBI and its director at the time, J. Edgar Hoover, which began as early as 1964, 4 years before he was assassinated. In fact, in October 1963, U.S. Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy authorized secret wiretapping of King's phones and kept the surveillance under wraps until a few weeks after the assassination. The FBI's continued use of surveillance in tandem with its efforts to defame King as a communist sympathizer, hardly comports with passive stories one would expect of the peaceful, non-confrontational character often described today. But rather than a truthful reckoning with his radical position on justice, many cling to King's earlier quotes and work, misrepresenting the full gamut of his contributions to the justice tradition. King was a staunch anti-war activist and spoke firmly against U.S. militarism in the Vietnam War. In an April 1967 speech called Beyond Vietnam, King called the war madness. This was a deeply radical and polarizing opinion in a moment when protests of the war had begun erupting across the country in New York, San Francisco, and Washington, D.C. In no uncertain terms, King articulated his opposition to the war in Vietnam, saying, "I knew that America would never invest in the necessary funds or energies in rehabilitation of its poor so long as adventures like Vietnam continued to draw men and skills and money like some demonic, destructive suction tube. So I was increasingly compelled to see the war as an enemy of the poor and to attack it as such." These opinions not only made him unpopular, as 64% of Americans approved of the war, according to an October 1965 Gallup poll, they highlighted his increasing distance from mainstream American politics that called for the respectability, quiet assimilation, and good behavior of Black Americans. In fact, polling during the 1960s reflects how polarizing King's radical work truly was for the U.S. citizens. In 1965, Gallup found that King had a 45% positive and 45% negative rating. And in 1966, the last year he was included in the poll, his positive rating dropped to 32%, while his negative rating increased to 63%. However, by 2011, his rating was 94% positive. This vast swing in approval of King today isn't rooted in his radical legacy. Rather, it's the product of generations of appropriation of his liberatory work and a whitening of his effort to ensure more freedom for those least likely to attain it in the United States. Figures like President Barack Obama have reminded us that King once said, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice." But over time, the great orator's writing became less magnanimous and ever more convinced that white supremacy was the most significant obstacle in attaining liberation for all Black people. In his final book, Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos or Community, originally published in 1967, King wrote that whites, it must frankly be said, are not putting in a similar mass effort to re-educate themselves out of their racial ignorance. It is an aspect of their sense of superiority that the white people of America believe they have so little to learn. The reality of substantial investment to assist Negroes into the 20th century, adjusting to Negro neighbors and genuine school integration, is still a nightmare for all too many white Americans. He continued, "These are the deepest causes for contemporary abrasions between the races. Loose and easy language about equality, resonant resolutions about brotherhood fall pleasantly on the ear. But for the Negro, there is a credibility gap we cannot overlook." He remembers that with each modest advance, the white population promptly raises the argument that the Negro has come far enough. Each step forward accents an ever-present tendency to backlash. By this point in his life, King had abandoned the rose-colored glasses of his youth. Instead, he was laser-focused on addressing white supremacy in its basest and most intimate forms, in communities, schools, and neighborhoods. This departure from his colorblind rhetoric of yore was an indication that King was becoming politicized by his experiences in the movement. Essentially, he was getting woke. King's beliefs in a more radical vision for America became manifest in his later social organizing work. In early 1968, King planned the Poor People's Campaign, a march on Washington, D.C., meant to demand greater attention to the economic disparities between class groups, disparities that most frequently had a disproportionate effect on black people. The campaign had a radical vision, one that demanded access to housing, employment, and health care for those historically denied those rights. While it had no specific racial target, it challenged Congress to pass sweeping anti-poverty legislation. Unfortunately, King was killed before he was able to complete the Poor People's March. He was 39 years old. While as many as 50,000 people marched on Washington, the effort fizzled out with King's leadership as the nation mourned his death. This Martin Luther King Jr. Day, we would do his memory justice by honoring all of his legacy, not just the parts that make white Americans comfortable. Our next article from Teen Vogue is titled, Lizzo's Detox: Posts Show How Susceptible We Are to Diet Culture. More upsetting than one's individual choices is the culture that leads us to think detox diets are real. This article is by Brittany McNamara and was published December 15, 2020. Lizzo is known for her confidence and unapologetic love for her body, but she's now facing backlash after documenting a 10-day smoothie detox on her Instagram. On December 14th, Lizzo posted two reels to her Instagram, documenting her daily progress during a 10-day smoothie diet. In the posts, she said she had drank a lot, and I ate a lot of food that messed my stomach up in Mexico, prompting her to try the cleanse. She documented what she ate and drank during the diet, showing daily pictures of herself to show results. Explaining why she went on the diet, Lizzo said, I think I just wanted to stress eat and do things that were like kind of self-harming. I think that it's just great to reset your stomach and reset things, especially when you deal with gastrointestinal issues like I do. But I think I look great too. But many fans were quick to call Lizzo out, noting that her smoothie detox prompted diet culture. I really thought this was a safe space, but promoting detox and cleanse that is a part of the diet culture, one commenter wrote to Lizzo's post. This, as they say, ain't it. Not now, during a year and season when people are struggling with extra hard with body issues, and not ever, someone else wrote. The comments flooded in, some expressing anger at Lizzo's choice, while others felt upset to see someone they heralded as a beacon of self-love engaging in diet culture. In response, Lizzo posted a series of Instagram stories defending her diet, saying weight loss wasn't the goal. As you know, I would normally be afraid and ashamed to post things like this online, because I feel like, as a big girl, people just expect if you're doing something for your health, you're doing it for, like, a dramatic weight loss. And that is not the case, she said. In reality, November stressed me out. I drank a lot, I ate a lot of spicy things, and things that messed my stomach up, and I wanted to reverse it and get back to where I was. I'm proud of myself. I'm proud of my results. My sleep has improved, my hydration, my inner peace, my mental stability, my body, my skin, the whites of my eyes. I feel and look like a beautiful woman, and I think like that, she continued. I'm a big girl who did a smoothie detox, and I wanted to share that with you guys. I got exactly what I wanted out of it, and every big girl should do whatever they want with their bodies. Lizzo's right that we should be able to do whatever we want with our bodies, and it's great that for a period of stress and gastrointestinal upset, she wanted to change how she ate to feel healthier. But detox diets can be harmful and promote potentially dangerous myths about how our bodies work. I would say the bottom line is that there really isn't any clear evidence that a detox or cleansing programs can actually make you healthier or improve your health, or that it removes toxins from your body. Navia Misur, MD, previously told Teen Vogue about detox diets. Instead of quick fixes or so-called resets, Misur recommended trying to find a balance in your diet by eating healthy whole foods. Beyond the lack of evidence in cleanses, a diet like Lizzo's could be triggering for people with eating disorders. Anything that recommends restricting food is potentially harmful for some people, which wouldn't be a problem for someone who isn't in the public eye. But since Lizzo has so many followers, her sharing her diet could be upsetting to someone. Ultimately, Lizzo did nothing really wrong. She made a choice about her own body that she said made her feel good, and that's her right. She's one person, and while many idolize her and look up to her for their body acceptance, she's human. Even the most body positive people have likely succumbed to some part of diet culture. And honestly, that's okay. And it's not our place to police her body. More upsetting than Lizzo's individual choice is the diet culture that tells us we need to fix our bodies or reset them with procedures or plans that we must buy. Rather than idealizing things like balance in our diets and self-acceptance for when we indulge in ways that make us crave more of that balance, diet culture tells us a detox is a quick fix. In reality, it's a less than scientific way of making us think restricting food means health. And our final article, first COVID vaccine in U.S. goes to New York City ICU nurse. This is by Brittany McNamara, published December 14, 2020. For healthcare workers, the day we've all hoped for since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic in the United States is here. The first round of non-trial vaccines against the potentially deadly virus has started. On Monday, December 14th, a critical care nurse in New York City became one of the first in the United States to get the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine, marking a pivotal day in history. CNN reports that Sandra Lindsay, an ICU nurse at Long Island Jewish Medical Center in Queens, was inoculated against COVID-19 on a live video stream, saying she's feeling well and that the shot felt like any other. "I feel hopeful today," she relieved, she said. I'm sorry. "I feel hopeful today, relieved," she said, according to CNN. "I feel like healing is coming. I hope this marks the beginning of the end of a very painful time in our history." Still, Lindsay stressed that we need to continue to take precautions against spreading COVID-19, like wearing masks if we go out in public and keeping distance from others. Like the vaccine, these recommendations, Lindsay said, are driven by science, which she believes is the way out of the pandemic. "There's light at the end of the tunnel, but we still need to continue to wear our masks and to social distance. I believe in science. As a nurse, my practice is guided by science, and so I trust that," she says. "What I don't trust is that if I contract COVID, I don't know how it will impact me or those who I come in contact with. So I encourage everyone to take the vaccine." Lindsay was one of many to be vaccinated on Monday, the first step in a nationwide vaccination campaign. Distribution will be driven by individual states, but the CDC recommends healthcare workers and residents of long-term care facilities be the first to get the vaccine. According to NBC News, most Americans won't get the vaccine until next spring. But as the first round of vaccines start, the country will face multiple battles, including fighting the rise of COVID cases and convincing people skeptical about the vaccine to get it once it becomes available. In an appearance on the Today Show, Health and Human Service Alex Azar reminded the public that despite the fast track the COVID vaccine was on, it has gone through every aspect of the FDA process with integrity and transparent data. If you are recommended to get it and it's available for you, please do get it. Protect yourself and protect those around you, he said. And to round out today's episode, I wanted to give a podcast recommendation from Teen Vogue called Teenage Therapy. Here's a concept: real teens talking about their very real thoughts, concerns, and daily lives. Sound compelling? That's the idea behind Teenager Therapy, a weekly podcast hosted by a roundtable of stressed, sleep-deprived, yet energetic high schoolers. In an era where most stories about teenhood are being told by adults, Teenager Therapy is a fresh look at the coming-of-age experience in 2020 and beyond, an undeniably weird year for young people. These teens have had their lives upended by a global health pandemic, and they've also had to navigate a crucial presidential election from the sidelines. And this conversational podcast goes into all of that and more. Not to mention, they scored a coveted review with Prince Harry and Meghan Markle, in which they talked about mental health, stigma, and mental burnout. A recent episode finds the teens lamenting virtual school and breaking down why cheating is a necessary tool in an American public school system that values test scores more than actual learning. Other episodes include conversations about activism, overnight TikTok fame, and feeling like a burden to your friends. Adolescence is a universal experience, but each generation has their own issues, and Teenager Therapy, because we have problems too, is an empathetic exploration into Gen Z for teens and curious adults too. All right, we have run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazine. Please be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Bahati Mutisia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Teen Magazines is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.